Welcome, everyone, and good evening. Thank you so much for coming. My name is Colin McClay. I'm the Managing Director of the Berkman Center, and I am thrilled to have you here for this very special event in this very special place, which, although I've been around Harvard Law School for about 4 or 5 years now, I've never even really heard of before this event happened. So this is a big deal to be in here, and great thanks to the Dean and HLS for allowing us to be here. So it's my great pleasure to have the honor to introduce to you Nicholas Negroponte, who really, as they say, needs no introduction, so I will not be tempted to engage in a long one, which I list things like co-founder of the Media Lab and author of Being Digital and all these things that many of you will be very familiar with. What I would say is that he is, as you know, a big thinker, and that big thinkerness, I think, comes in volume, as we have seen, not the size of the cranium, but in terms of the size of the ambition. In the case of EXO, talking about lots of a million to start with, it's big. It didn't surprise me, I must confess, because I did hearken back to a project that I was involved in with my colleague Mike Best some years ago when we planned to wire an entire district, or wireless an entire district in India, something on the order of 2 or 3 million people, which at the time and probably now would have been the most densely connected rural poor place in the world, to which Nicholas said, dangerously small. So this is how he thinks. He thinks big. And I think the excitement of that is that it means that he thinks big when he thinks about changing education and learning, and that this project isn't really about the device so much, although the devices are very nifty, but it's about what it means to learning and what it means to shift the paradigms that we're all so familiar with, particularly those in the developing world. And I think his participation tonight is particularly useful in that in our some of our discussions earlier this afternoon, we found ourselves coming back time and again to the same old problems we've dealt with respect to copyright, file sharing, fair use questions, these kinds of issues, which are kinds of back and forth within the US that matter, but don't matter quite the same way as they do in developing countries. And what the EXO and OLPC and all the attention and the competition, in fact, which has been so important to this movement, have generated this enthusiasm and this recasting, I think it should remind us, those of us here, to think about a larger context, to think about the world, to think about not just solving problems in Western Europe and North America, but the impact of technology and learning and everything we do to enable them to be effectively used at a global level. So with that, I give you Nicholas, who will speak for on the order of 20 minutes and then very generously has consented to do lots of Q&A. Just one word of note, I would say that there is a camera there, so if you could stay out of this line, that'd be most appreciated. So, Nicholas, take it away.
Thank you. Okay. The single most important thing that I can get you to remember, and everybody's going to forget, but I'll keep trying to remind you, and I will look like I have forgotten it periodically, and that is that this is an education project, not a laptop project. Happens that the laptop is cool as hell, so we all sort of spend a lot of time looking at this wonderful, marvelous laptop, but it really is an education project, and the reason it was started was a very simple belief that all the big problems of this world, the really big ones, whether it's peace, the elimination of poverty, the environment, that they're all addressed with solutions, there's always an S, that include education, in some cases could be just education, and in no instance are without an element of education. So by tackling education, particularly primary education, we think that that's, if you will, the tool to do much bigger things. And if you look around at the world, there are, in rough numbers, 1.2 billion children in the primary, secondary age group. 50% of them have no electricity. 50% are rural. Usually those overlap considerably. You have some countries like Nigeria and Pakistan where 50% of the children get no education, period. And I don't mean because they're in the sixth grade. I'm talking about first graders. In Afghanistan, 75% of the young girls get no education. I mean, you've got some numbers that are absolutely horrifying. And what's also important is if you go to these remote places, and I'm talking about remote parts of poor countries, it's often a tree, if you're lucky. The teacher probably has very little training or qualification. As teachers get that, they will migrate to the city. They won't want to stay in the rural and remote parts. And so when you look at the sort of education landscape around the world, it's pretty grim. And how do you fix that? The answer is certainly not by building more schools and training more teachers, not in the sense that that's a bad thing to do, but that's going to take a very, very long time. So we should certainly continue doing that, but that's not the way over the next, at least in my lifetime, that that's going to change. What you have to do is leverage the children. So we took, if you will, pages out of our own history. We didn't wake up one morning and say, we're going to build a laptop. You know, I'm constantly asked, when did the idea come? This goes back to 1967, 68, when Seymour Papert first introduced Logo in April, more precisely April 11th, 1970. He gave the first major public address called Teaching Children Thinking. It certainly affected me, many of my colleagues. I was already on the faculty at MIT, and at least 25% of the Media Lab since its inception had, if you will, children in learning as a component, whether that's measured in the number of people, the number of dollars we spent, whatever. So children in learning is not a new topic. And the twist that Seymour brought to it was that the best way for a child to learn is really by doing. And in particular, if a child can write a computer program, the process of writing the program is in fact the closest you can get to thinking about thinking. And that if a child has to write a program to make a circle, that child's going to understand circleness a lot better than it being just drawn on a blackboard or being told about radiuses and diameters and circumferences. And even more importantly, and I'm really going back 30 years, more importantly, that whenever you write a program, it never works the first time, so you have to debug it. And the process of debugging is literally the closest we can come to learning about learning. And we found that kids in the 1970s who were involved in programming, the debuggers, if you will, actually took that experience into their own learning and how they were learning in other subjects like spelling and so on. I remember, I'm a terrible speller, and when I was a kid, if I got 8 out of 10 words right, the B was glorious. And I really loved a B in spelling, and I certainly was not interested in the 2 words I got wrong. I really wasn't interested. The debuggers loved the 2 words they got wrong, you know, and they would look at them and so on. It's just a lot. Now, that sounds very abstract. In 1982, Seymour and I started doing work in Senegal, Cambodia, and Pakistan, way ahead of its time. The IBM PC wasn't even around. Steve Jobs gave us a few hundred Apple IIs. We were doing schools outside of Dakar, way ahead. Didn't sustain itself, it didn't continue. But the one thing we learned in 82 is that kids in Africa didn't speak English or French. In fact, the kids we were working with spoke only Wolof, okay? And they played those keyboards like pianos. And when I hear people ask me, and it's often asked, who's going to teach the teachers to teach the children to use computers, I wonder, what planet are they on? Okay. There's not a person in this room who hasn't asked a child for help using a computer. Probably your own child. Okay. And not only did you ask your child, it actually improved your relationship with your child. Okay, it established a kind of relationship that I certainly didn't have with my parents, not because my parents were horrible, they were wonderful, but it was a different child-parent relationship. And the self-esteem that kids get from helping their parents, helping their aunts and uncles, helping their friends is really quite important. So we said, could we take some of this, and I'm going to walk you through some slides very, very quickly, could we take this and sort of basically amplify it?
It's kind of embarrassing to have to put on a pair of glasses to see which side is forward. There we go.
That's Seymour 27 years ago outside of Dakar. And this school, which for me was very much the motivation, was built in 1999 in a village in Cambodia, has an annual income, the per capita income in that village is $47 per year. I'm not making a mistake. That's per year. Okay. And so that's less than a dollar a week, none of this dollar a day stuff. No electricity, no telephone, no nothing. There are now five villages. Two of them don't even have a road. You can't get there in July and August. And what happened, and for a whole set of circumstances, I won't go into it, we connected the village, brought in the satellite you see in the background, and the kids take these laptops at home at night. They're connected broadband to the internet. They've never seen a cell phone. They've never seen a landline, and they use Skype every day. Okay, the first English word of every kid in that picture was Google. Okay. And the parents loved it when the kids took the laptops home because it was the brightest light source in the house. Okay, there's no electricity. Oil is expensive. Oil lamps are expensive. That laptop opens and just illuminated. They all live in single rooms, the whole family. And I looked at this, and it's kind of a boutique experiment. It had a tooth fairy, in this case was me, had sort of people doing it. And I said, does that scale? Could you scale it? Could you do it on sort of a planetary level? Could you do it, you know, very, very large? And if you look at the communications piece, it's very elastic. This happens to be a megabit down and a half a megabit up, and you know, there are 50 kids, then 10 more kids come. It's okay, it's kind of elastic. But if you believe in one laptop per child, there's no elasticity. You get 10 more kids, you need 10 more laptops. And so we looked at this and asked ourselves, why is that device so expensive? And the reason it's expensive is very simple. The electronics industry, and I can say this with some authority actually, goes, the price of all electronics drops 50% every 18 months. So what do you do if that's your DNA? Okay. What you do is you add features. And hopefully you can add enough features that, for instance, your cell phone that you last bought, the next time you buy one, you're going to at least pay as much, because you don't, we really don't want you to pay less next time, because there are things like margins and shareholders and stuff like that. So what you do is you keep adding features, and we've done this so long, the fat lady can't sing anymore. Okay, your laptop works worse today than it did a decade ago. Powering off is a nightmare, powering up takes forever, and I bet you if we took a sample in this room, your laptop, unless you're using an Apple, crashes more than it ever did before. It's, in fact, we're at an inflection point, okay? It's like an SUV. You're using most of your gasoline to move this ridiculous heavy car, okay? And it just doesn't make any sense anymore. Every laptop is an SUV today. So could we, in fact, revisit it, redesign from the bottom up? This isn't cost-downing a laptop and sort of trying to make it cheaper, and could we rethink it? So this is what we did. Very quickly, first decision we made, which quite frankly is, I think, the most important, is we created a nonprofit. That is absolutely critical, that we were a nonprofit so that the clarity of purpose was just impeccable. And it's given us license to speak to whomever we want. Heads of state will see us. You know, I may sound like a laptop salesman at time, okay, but it's a nonprofit. I don't even draw a salary. So people get the picture pretty clearly that there's something different about this. And I put scale there not because of trying to get the component cost down, but which is obvious, but it's because you can change corporate strategy. I'll give you a very specific example. When I started this project, I went, because of the Media Lab, you know all these characters, okay? I'm older than most of them, so you know them. And they usually take my phone call. Certainly when I started Wired Magazine, they took my phone call, okay? But they even took it afterwards. And went to the display manufacturer and said, you know, we need a not too big a one, it's, you know, it can have some color defects, it's, you know, it just has to be very inexpensive. And he said to me, he said, Nicholas, you know, we our corporate strategy is to make large, bright, you know, without any color artifacts or defects, displays. So our corporate strategy and your project are just incompatible. We're sorry, we can't help you. And I said, that's a shame, because we need 100 million units a year. And he said, well, let me rethink. And they did. And the display manufacturer today just invested $1 billion in a fab to make the display you see on that laptop. Okay, why would a manufacturer invest $1 billion? It's because it's big. The scale is there, and there's the motivation to do it. So the real issue of scale is changing corporate strategy. So when they come to you and say, eh, they start whining, no whining allowed. We're talking about tens of millions, and it really gets things moving in a very, very different way. It also gets people angry. The partners aren't as important, perhaps, except the two in the upper right, which you may never have heard of. Quanta makes 40% of the world's laptops. Okay, so your laptop was probably made by Quanta. They make most of the Apples, Dells, HPs, Compaq, so on. And the one below, which I'm sure you've never heard of, is the world's largest producer of plastics and the Taiwan's second largest producer of LCDs. So they're very important players. In fact, when Quanta joined, was very important because a lot of people initially said, great project, wonderful, but they can't do it. And that meant one of two things. They, namely us, as a bunch of academics, couldn't do it. Or it meant that nobody could do it. And that was kind of what the street was thinking. Quanta comes along, raises their hand, and says, we'll do it. It took the wind out of everybody's sails. They said, it's going to happen. So now the question isn't, will it happen, but kind of when, how much, and so on. So Quanta was very important. We announced it with Kofi Annan in November, a year and a half ago. Anything you do with Kofi Annan gets a lot of press. What's important was the picture. This was the machine we showed in Tunis. It's a charming image, absolutely unrealistic. We had wires under the table. It was working just fine. But what everybody remembers is the pencil yellow crank. Absolutely critical. That pencil yellow crank was in everybody's mind. I still today travel with the laptop and people say, where's the crank? The crank is off board, it's on the AC adapter, we have cranks, but having it on the picture, unrealistic as that was, you really don't want it on the laptop, I assure you, was absolutely perfect because people realize there's a toy-like look to it, it doesn't need to be plugged into the wall, and it just cast the right image way back then. And we've done something different, that's what, if you're interested in the technical stuff, that's what we've done. Oh, bless your heart, Windows. Now what has happened? Now what have I done? Jesus. I don't want to end the slideshow. Isn't this sweet? Okay. It's a battle. It's a real battle. There we go. doesn't it ruin your day? I mean, it ruins mine every day. There are three things in bold that I just wanted to put there, which just emphasize there are several laptops, there are people from one laptop per child. Maybe you can raise your hand. Let me say, I see SJ, there's a couple of people back there. There are laptops. There are a couple of people in the back. And sort of afterwards, if you haven't played with it, please do. Are these B3s?
They're mostly B2s.
Mostly B2s. Okay. Any B3s here? You have a pre-B3, in fact. Okay, in back. Okay, there's one back there that is this spec, and it's really quite glory. Do you have Sesame Street in Urdu?
We can just...
Good, yeah, okay. there are three things that you should know. One is that the average power consumption, which is very important, is less than 2 watts compared to your laptop, which is 35 or 40. You've probably heard of the Classmate, which is Intel's so-called knockoff. It has a 65-watt power supply. Okay, 65 watts. If Libya were to adopt the Classmate, they'd have to build a power plant. Okay, so that number is really important. And you also want to be able to use human power and everybody in this room, since nobody, we tend not to be malnourished or small, we can generate about 15 to 20 watts of power. So you want a 1-to-10 ratio. The mesh network is important because you go into places that they have to make, has to make the network. And the dual mode display, we're not going to be able to see it very well in here. But I was in Washington at the World Bank today showing it in the broad sunlight, and it's just incredible. It's about 3 times the resolution of your laptop in black and white reflective mode out in the sunlight. Kids have to use it in the sunlight, and the reading experience has got to be as good or better than paper. So it's a totally different sort of objective than. So this is the laptop, which you'll see. I won't spend much time on it, but it works in sort of a games mode, and you've got the right person here, SJ, who tell you all about that. And it works in sort of other modes. Here is the, everybody smiles when the ears, whoops, ears come up. Let's get the ears back up. Oh, how did that happen? Sorry. See if I can go back one. There it is. The ears are up. Everybody smiles. The reason for that is because of those antennae, you get very long reach. I was in Vietnam at a meeting in a conference room with about 30 people, had their laptops open, and nobody got a wireless signal except me. Okay, and those ears really, really help a great deal. And at any rate, it folds up. So a few more comments, and then this picture to me means a lot, maybe not to you. This was the first one going down the real assembly line with the real people, with the real combo. I mean, this is real. In other words, these are not hand assembled and made. I mean, we had a lot of those. I used to carry plastic models. These are off a real assembly line outside of Shanghai. And this particular assembly line makes everything. It makes iBooks, it makes HPs. It takes them 23 minutes to change the assembly line and a different laptop is moving down it. And this particular line can make 40,000 a month. They can run multiple lines. They're tooling up to make 1 million a month by December. And just to put that in context, 1 million a month isn't a very big number. But the world production of laptops, taking all the manufacturers worldwide, Japanese, Korean, American, is 5 million a month. So we're telling you that by the end of December, we're ramped to do 20% of the current world production is one of the reasons we are getting so much attention and grief. This is the, oh God, it doesn't backspace without bringing me into this mode, and that's probably not Windows' fault. That's just one of the power generating devices that a little bit bigger than a hockey puck and generate. I mean, when you generate this way, you can generate more electricity. The mesh network is probably, is there a wireless signal in here in the room?
A little bit.
There's a little bit. Well, if there's a little bit, we should be able to get it, right? So we'll see. We try to go into the most rural and most remote places. We encourage governments to do it in the remote rural places first. Peru just agreed to do their one-room schools in the most remote regions. In Pakistan, we're looking at Kashmir and the northern territories. We're looking at the areas that separate Afghanistan. And in the case of Kashmir, we will probably use the military to bring the stuff in because there's kind of no way to get there. So the general who runs the special command operations has basically given us their helicopters, their troops. We'll train troops to bring this stuff in, and they'll all come in on helicopters. There's a lot of local sort of sub-mesh, sub-satellite sort of stuff that gets done. I won't go into it. You'll see that the interface is designed for sharing. Okay, sharing is absolutely critical. This mesh network isn't just a means to connect the kids in places that are unconnected, but the underlying principle, and Walter Bender, who's not here tonight, this is really thanks to him, is that learning is about sharing and about creating things together. And the whole interface is based, when you get on there, you see who's on there, and so on and so forth. It also runs Windows, and it may even run the Apple software. It does a lot of things. Here are the countries we're launching in. The color coding isn't too important, but the original countries were big. They were Argentina, Nigeria, and Thailand. the idea was to get three countries, the head of state in each case kind of agreed to it, and so we got rolling. Now, one of the problems with going to big countries is they're just that. They're big countries, so they're also markets, and we found ourselves in the crossfire, if you will, between AMD and Intel, so there's certain amount of casualty along the way. These are the countries that are currently involved. If you ask me which one has signed up and sent us a check, the answer is none yet, because we don't even ask them for that. We want them to basically launch it, and in some cases, Rwanda, Libya, and Uruguay, they have agreed to do every child in the country. And to me, that's stunning. If you could really do every single child in a country, and those are noticeably small countries, it's to me, you know, very, very important. A few pictures, and then I'll stop. Some of these just came in this week. These kids are in Cambodia. They're in the same school you saw at the beginning. They're kind of pros. They've been living with laptops now for quite a while. But we get them to do a lot of testing for us. This classroom does the most testing. They've been really brutal. This one is in Nigeria. The machines get, first of all, we didn't pay attention. I don't know if you can tell from the picture, but these desks are sloped. We hadn't thought about that. And so the person who's there tells us that every 30 minutes, there's a crash. One of these things slides off the desk, and there's a crash. And they've even started in this school a laptop hospital. And the kids run the laptop hospital. I would love to put a little, you know how on things it says if you open this up, the warranty is invalid? I'd like to put a little sign in the back that says, warranty not valid until you open it up. Because we want the kids to open these things up, to repair them. What is... Good. I don't know what you're holding up. What is it?
It's a magazine that epitomizes that sort of attitude.
Good. Good. Great. At any rate, this is in Uruguay. This was the day the president of Uruguay went to that school, so I can't tell you if the kids are ecstatic about meeting the president or seeing the laptops, but the president was only there for 20 minutes, and the laptops have been there for about 2 weeks. And what's happening in all of these schools, for example, one common denominator is that the spouses of the teachers are complaining because they're all going into school on the weekends and staying late at night, okay? So it's things like that that are, in the first school I showed you in the slide, when the population of first grade doubled last year, okay? And they're not coming from other villages, okay? It's just that the kids in school last year in the first grade started telling the other kids in the village that school is cool, it's fun. And what happens, and this is true in a lot of places, but it's even more true in the developing world, you go into a classroom like the one in Nigeria, you go to a first grade class and the eyes are big and they're wide open and it's kind of a room full of these enthusiastic sponges that just want to absorb everything. And then by the fourth or fifth grade, the heads are down, they don't look at you in the face, this kind of a thing. And there's this belief that kids drop out of school in fifth, sixth grade to go work in the fields because there's an economic need. Rubbish. They drop out because school is boring. It's not only boring, it's often irrelevant. And that's really a very important, I mean, if we didn't believe that, we probably would operate very differently. But the passion for learning is the only thing we want these kids today. And we look at it more like, a program where you're inoculating people against ignorance. Okay, so if you want to build a vaccine or you want to vaccinate, you don't do it by doing just a village. You certainly can't do it with a control group to see whether it is really done. And this is more like vaccination. 2 minutes and I'll stop. Target. I probably should edit the slide. It's probably more 2009. We're very subject, our price floats. We're subject to the cost of, believe it or not, raw materials. Nickel has tripled since we started this project, literally tripled cost per ton. And so we're taking nickel out of it. We're leaving nickel and going to lithium ferrite just to get back to a price. But so the costs of things float. We're currently at about 176. We can get down to 50, et cetera. Gray markets, very important in these countries to make sure that we can deal with that issue. And there are two ways of doing it. One is interesting but not fail-safe, and the other, we think, added to it makes it fail-safe. The interesting one is you don't have a gray market if there's no secondary market. So in this country, thousands of cars are stolen every day, but not one single post office truck has ever been stolen in the United States. Okay, because there's no secondary market for post office trucks. And the reason is that they always look like post office trucks. You can spray paint it and so on. So the idea was, could we make the laptops sufficiently distinct, not have a gray market, not have a commercial market, I should say, and that would help the problem. It doesn't solve it, but it helps it. And the second thing is there's a lot of technology in it that a lot of security. So for example, if it's stolen before the kids get it, it's inoperable. If it's stolen after a child gets it, it can be disabled remotely, or if it's not on the mesh network for a certain period of time, 24, 36, 48 hours, it also gets disabled. So you got to tell people these things or they're going to steal a truck full of them anyway. But you really, there's a lot of technology in there. In fact, the young man who's in charge of that did such a good job, he gave the keynote at a very large security conference, computer and security conference recently, and one of the press stories that came out afterwards was $1 million security for $100 laptop is the title of the story. I was thrilled. Again, I don't want to really go through this stuff. There are many ways of paying for this. Money's not really the problem. Launching is the problem. This is not an incremental process. You don't put 5,000 out and get then 50,000 and then 500,000. This is like a marathon where there are all people standing there with a little cord, and then somebody pulls the trigger, and then boom, it goes, and then once the avalanche starts. But we're at the point in time, and I mean in the next 30 days, I don't mean in the next 3 months, to pull that trigger. Okay, so if you see me even sounding hysterical, it's because I am. We're gonna pull this trigger very soon, and we need the means to do it. There's one last photograph. It just came in a few hours ago, so I thought I'd end on that photograph. And we put a handle on this thing so that people could carry it around. And this was just sent a few hours ago from Nigeria, and I thought I'd show it to you. So thank you very much. And now, whatever you... There's a roving mic. We have no secrets. You can ask anything you want, including controversial, hard questions.
Well, thank you very much for that talk. It was terrific.
Do you have to say who you are by name, just for other people to know,
sure.
The camera to at least record?
Yeah, Christopher Budnick, student at the Museum School, Northeastern University, member of Free Culture. My question is, first a preface. You went into how you jokingly said that maybe you'll put on the back that the warranty is void if not opened, right? Well, how do you relate this to the operating system? I think it was rather recently that it became clear that Microsoft would provide an operating system as an option.
Yeah.
It's not clear that operating system is going to be open. Kids aren't going to be able to tamper with it, play with it, break it, and learn how to fix it the same way they can do that with other operating systems. How does that kind of change the goal, or what is the kind of the deployment idea with that?
That's a very important question. OLPC is an open source house, open source operation, and we have five principles we require each country to abide by for us to even be there, one of which is open source. One of the reasons to put, or at least to have Windows also run on it, is it's hard for me to tell somebody I'm open source, where the keyword is open, but I'm going to exclude something. So the fact that it can run seems to me in keeping with being open. The fact that itself isn't open, nor is the AMD processor. There's a processor in there, the schematics of which I can't give you. And there are other components in there that aren't open in the way you and I might want to use open. But as long as open is, if you will, the basic DNA of this machine, by putting Windows on it, it allows governments to hedge. It allows them to feel that it's not a toy. It actually brings a certain amount of advantage. If I were to tell you tonight, which I'm not going to because it's not true, but if I were to tell you tonight, we're putting Windows and that's our operating system, everybody at OLPC would resign tomorrow. They would. I'm sorry? And the price would go, except that notice that Microsoft dropped it to $3 recently. And that $3 drop, I mean, drop to $3 was very important. And we encouraged them to do that. And if you read stories about it, you'd see in the second line, or certainly in the first paragraph, usually in the second line, sometimes even in the first line, it said, because of OLPC. And Intel made the class made. A lot of people did things. So we don't have shareholders. We could declare victory and pack up our tent. I don't need to make a laptop, okay? But if we did that, price of Windows would go up, Classmate would disappear. We have to keep going, and we have to remain open, and we have to keep driving the price down. If nothing else, to keep perpetuating this and to keep the slope down in terms of price. Calls. Yes.
Hi. My name is Michael Rand, and I'm a former educator, got a master's of education at Teachers College Columbia, and now I'm an MBA student at Brook College. Mm-hmm. And as a marketing major, I heard your presentation on 60 Minutes, and you mentioned how you described geeks around you to help build the machine. And my sense is that, given what I'm doing now, wouldn't it have been better, and this is the question, if you had also brought along some marketing people and maybe some human resource people, some people from the Sloan School, next door to where you guys are doing your work. Mm-hmm. And if you had, do you think that would have made a difference vis-a-vis the problems you're having, getting that firm number of orders so that you can actually go ahead and build a machine? And what would you do differently now that you know all these problems, mm-hmm. If you had the chance to do it over again?
Yeah. We have a board. We have a lot of people who advise us from the business side, and gurus who write textbooks on it, and the Sloan School and the Media Lab have an affinity because they were always the odd ducks on campus. We never played by the rules, okay? And we broke rules, and Lester Thoreau, who was my counterpart at Sloan School, broke rules, and there was a great affinity. In fact, people, if you say Sloan School or you say Media Lab, they roll their eyeballs at MIT because we're usually the thorn in the institute's side. So a lot of these people are close friends, people who helped in the beginning. And I go to them for their advice all the time, and I usually invert the sign bit. They say do X, and I do the opposite, okay? Because they are so trained to commercial marketing ventures that things like first to market, this advantage for the, and I'm saying, boy, that's just not what we're doing. We are not, it's almost more as if you're starting a religion and you want this to spread and you want people to, but it's not as if you're trying to suddenly introduce a product and have it go through the normal channel and so on. So something like 60 Minutes, God, we couldn't have asked for better. I mean, that was as good as it gets on 60 Minutes. And it was very important because it just got a message out, albeit to an American audience, that I thought was very important. When people say, are you going to make it or not make it? You're damn right we're going to make it. There's just absolutely no question. What might happen is we might slip 15 days, we might slip 20 days, we might have to do something, slightly differently. But I wouldn't go back and surround ourselves with marketing people. Depending on how you count, you can't really count the open source community, but if you count the people who work on this day in, day out, there are 250 people at the moment. And most of them are in Taiwan. Most of them relate to Quanta or Chimay. Back here in Cambridge, we may be 35 or 40. And then there are people in countries and so on. It's not a big number. But whatever that number is, if you ask how many people are in whatever the equivalent of marketing and sales is, you're looking at it. It's one person. And the reason it's one person is it's much more credible. Okay? We, you know, it's no secret. Yeah. What?
About two or three.
No. Well, we can do, you know, it's sure. Yeah, if you're looking for a job, come see us. Yeah. I mean, you know, we have to change. Okay, it's not going to be that forever, but right now, the charm of that is quite important, and it's not as if we have a PR department, a sales department, a marketing department, and so on. And you know, if we did, these guys wouldn't see me. Okay, but they do see us, and so we can get them thinking. And if at the end they all run out and buy Classmates, that's terrific. Okay, that's wonderful. So it's a funny thing. Since we don't have shareholders, we don't have the normal issues of releasing things. So I wouldn't change that. There are other things I'd change, but I don't think I'd change that. Yes?
Why will the laptop not be available commercially?
It will be available commercially under some brand which has nothing to do with us and will be probably sold on a basis of pay for two and get one. Just like, you know, when you buy a shirt, you can pay for one and get two. We're going to do the opposite, pay for two and get one. So when you buy one, a kid in Africa gets one or so on. When that happens, and let me say 8-12 months from now, it will be somebody else, not us. The reason we don't do it and the reason that isn't the economic model from the onset is that it's too incremental. And if we start doing anything commercial, then the clarity of purpose goes away. And so we've tried to keep it relatively pure. We may strike up some commercial deals like selling the display or the rights to it or, you know, doing these buy two, get one deals, but they're going to happen after launch. We've got to launch it differently. Sure.
The mic over here.
Over here. Okay.
Hi.
Yes.
Hi, I'm Jean Diaz.
Yes.
I'm from across the street, Lesley University. I'm a teacher educator.
Yes.
So I really appreciate the way that you began
mm-hmm.
with saying that all the world's problems today have solutions and they're all started in education.
Mm-hmm.
And I really believe that. So mm-hmm. first of all, I want to thank you for beginning there because that's, I think, the basis of what you're doing, and I really admire that.
Mm-hmm.
So my questions are about, I have lots of questions, so I'll just start with one. And that is the vision of what kids do with this. Where will they go, and what do you do in terms of this network that they set up? Or how do you vision where they go with this? Because my understanding with kids and all my teaching is that they always do things you don't expect them to do. And that's what's so exciting. And so that, yeah.
Yeah.
But in terms of learning.
Yeah.
And what kind of visioning have you done with that? And where does this go? The other question I have, which you won't address, is the issue of plastic is forever and waste, et cetera. And the environment.
No, I will address that because it turns out that this laptop is the greenest laptop that has ever been built by an order of magnitude, not by 20%, but by a factor of 10, okay? In terms of, first of all, there are none of there's no mercury in it, there are none of the heavy metals, there's this none of the stuff, and by measures, and I forget, SJ, where are you? SJ, what is the name of the environmental agents? They have a gold medal that they have never issued, okay? And they came to us, and after seeing the laptop, they said, we're going to make a platinum one to issue to you. So the environmental side of this, and it's not green for that reason. It's green for another reason, which I may tell you. It is a story. But what the kids will do, the most important thing to us is that it be seamless in their lives. that they use it for music, they use it for games, they use it for look at movies, they use it for books, they use it for communicating, they use it in school, out school, the whole thing, that it gets used very seamlessly so that learning isn't just what you do at school, it's life. So we sort of look at it from that point of view. In each country, there's a very, very different approach to education. Some countries, we have to go in with what I call a Trojan horse approach. And that is simply to say, this is merely an ebook. And so it'll come with 100 books, 1,000 books, it'll come with the textbooks, and so on and so forth, and that's it. It's not disruptive. Kids use it as, they don't have textbooks. So Brazil and China both spend $19 per year per child on textbooks. So just going in as a textbook is economically justifying it. Then at night, the kids come out, like in the Trojan horse, they come out and they use it as a laptop. And this is slightly subversive, but it doesn't disrupt school if they think of school in a very fixed and disciplined way. The other would be to take the Seymour Papert approach from the get-go and to really have this much more constructionist, much more sort of engaging in the class and so on and so forth. And there are mixes of this in between. And again, I just got, along with that picture this afternoon, some extraordinary report from Nigeria where the teachers, you know, they just completely changed the way the teachers teach. And there is this image we've cast, and it's our mistake because we've somehow done this, that we are kind of anti-teacher, anti-school, and so on. No, we're pro-child, okay, and inside and outside school. Let me tell you the story why it's green, and then I'll stop because unfortunately I have to do my usual trick, which is catch an airplane. When we started the project, I said we went to Brazil, Nigeria, Thailand. I knew previously Thaksin Shinawatra, who was at the time Prime Minister of Thailand, and I knew Lula not well, but I certainly knew well, but I didn't know Obasanjo, who was the president of Nigeria. So I go to see Obasanjo, who, if you've ever seen pictures of him, is kind of sort of always wears robes, never wears suits, pretty big guy with his flowing robes and so on, and had basically a cabinet meeting in his villa. The villa is the equivalent of his White House. And so there's this long table with all the ministers sitting at one end and me all alone on the other end, sort of the head empty. He comes in the room with his blue flowing robes and everybody stands up, everybody sits down, and he sits down. I had never met the man. He points his finger at me and he says, "Professor Negroponte, I have one word for your project." And so everybody's like a cliffhanger. Everybody's waiting for the one word. And the one word was enchanting. I said, "Wow, enchanting." And I went back on such a high. This was 2 years ago. I said, "Enchanting. Yes, goddammit, this is enchanting." And that and Lula and Thaksin sort of supporting. And so I went back, and we made the first machines went to Nigeria, and that's the Nigerian flag. The colors of the Nigerian flag are white and green. And that's how it became white and green. And it propelled them. Last time I saw him, I brought him one. I said, "The only reason to come and see you is to thank you." And he is no longer president of Nigeria as of about 2 or 3 weeks ago. But that's how it became green and white. So on that note, I'm going to stop because I really do have to leave. But thank you very much and for standing.